coming in. Good evening, everybody. I'm Neil Hobhouse. I'm a LSE governor and the chair of the Cities Programme Advisory Board. This is the first of our annual series of Jane Jacobs lectures. Next week, Ira Katznelson, the sociology, the professor of sociology from Columbia, is going to give two lectures, and then in the middle of March, Gabriella Tanaturi is going to be here talking about, from Bologna, talking about the city from a cultural perspective. For anybody who doesn't know, the Cities Programme is constantly trying to enlarge the purely physical space that the designer works in. And we try to do this by mixing in the studio social scientists, economists, social activists, and creating an exchange of information that allows us to think about space in a much more challenged way. Like every kind of interdisciplinary activity, it's a cocktail and it needs to be remixed all the time. And we try to do this by introducing the critique of observers who the critique of an observer from a world outside. The Jane Jacobs lectures, as you all probably know, are named after the first sociologist who really challenged the thinking of modernist architecture and planning by observing her own community in New York in the early 60s. Roger Grafe, who's going to speak this evening, is really the model of a Jane Jacobs lecturer, at least by any definition that we would like to, we could possibly produce. I mean, he's somebody who has been forced, I would say forced, I'm not sure that Roger would agree, to examine the space of the city by his own observation and commentary on community and on the causes of crime. I'm not going to try and tell you. I think I know, but I'm not going to try and tell you what Roger's going to say this evening, because it's exactly the kind of prejudgment that I would want to avoid. But for those people who don't know, he's one of our great documentary filmmakers. He's worked in England most of his life, producing, I counted 70 films, Roger, on the list you gave me, but I don't suppose that's... you've lost count, okay. And these films have been actually on a huge range of social topics. So I think really what's most telling, the ones that are most telling this evening, have been a series of extraordinary informal documentaries on, for instance, the internal workings of the Metropolitan Police, the prison system, the criminal justice system. And then I think one that Roger's particularly proud of was a famous omnibus program on the redevelopment of Cardiff, which really redirected the whole process. So this is actually, I think Roger would regard this as a real activist success in redirecting the whole process of planning. There's also an unbelievable list of public appointments, which I could spend most of the rest of the evening reciting. He's been on the board of the ICA, the British Film Institute. He's been a Fulbright commissioner. Again, specifically from our point of view, a board member of the London Transport Executive, and on these very important committees within London Transport on communication strategy and design. He's taught at the Architectural Association. He's acted as a consultant on the redevelopment of La Défense. And then in the field of crime, criminology, he's been a member of the Metropolitan Police Advisory Board on Race, and is currently a visiting fellow at the Mannheim, it's called the Mannheim Center for Criminology, here, I should know, here at the LSE. I'm going to, at the end of the lecture, Roger's going to talk for 45 or 50 minutes, at the end of the lecture talk, I would say, I'm going to ask Richard Sennett, who's the kind of intellectual force behind the Jane Jacobs lectures, to lead the discussion, and I hope we'll have up to half an hour for questions and discussion. Thank you very much.
It's terrific to be here, and I'm delighted so many people braved the weather, and you know, thank you for making the effort. This is a conversation, and as Neil implied, I've been sort of looking at cities and kind of what goes into cities and makes them work really all my life. I was born in New York, moved to London, and tried in various ways, because of my experience in New York, to try and head off the worst mistakes that I thought New York made. Not very successfully, I have to say, but I've done my best. One encounter I still remember with an architect who was involved in the London, the rebuilding of London after the war, and I kept saying to him, you know, why have you put up all these terrible tower blocks? Didn't you learn anything? You know, the replacing intimate housing, Jane Jacobs would have loved that, with these tower blocks, and then you did it again in Liverpool. And he said, no, I've actually stopped the rebuilding of tower blocks, the building of tower blocks in Liverpool. We've only put up 164 of them. And, you know, that idea that somehow, and they, of course they're starting to tear those down. There is this problem about learning, and it's a genuine problem. And the problem is that we have scripts in our heads that are kind of loops, and they're not open, they are loops, and they're self-reinforcing because on the whole, we read the newspapers that reinforce what we believe, we watch the programs that reinforce our opinions, and we hang out with people that also reinforce them, that share those assumptions that are in the scripts. And cities are very much kind of color-coded according to those scripts. And the people in charge of cities have a particular kind of script, a particular kind of vision of the way cities are organized that is born out of their experience and out of these scripts in their heads. And one of the most interesting things that I noticed, I've made lots of films about cities. I've made a film about Berlin, I made it with Gropius, I made a film about Florence, another one about Rome, and the radio stations were organizing, the free radio stations were linked into terrorism and fascism in Rome. Very, very interesting stuff. And one of the things I noticed was, and you can see it here in Camden, in those tower blocks as you go up Hampstead Road, that those tower blocks are named with rather strange names, the Deerfield and things. They actually, I realized they were councillors' names. They were named after the housing committee. And the point really about local government as opposed to national government is that usually it's working class people who have made good. And one of the reasons why they've torn down a lot of the low-rise housing was because it was either slums that they grew up in and hated and wanted to change, get rid of that memory, obliterate the memory, or they were middle-class homes, which symbolized their exclusion. And these were people from the country. In Florence, I noticed that it was very interesting. The people who moved into Florence were very often contadini who had been in the country, literally peasants who had worked on the land. And when they came into the city, their experience of the city was hostile. And therefore, they didn't really love the urbanity of people who had been born into and celebrated the diversity that in the uses of disorder and so on that we see, you know, really as a kind of resource in the city. And so people are always trying to tidy them up. They're always trying to, you know, make cities neater than they should be. But of course they fail. And then what happens is that their image of the city, and you've seen this in all those ghastly architectural drawings of, you know, smiling multiracial families sitting under Campari umbrellas, always in full sun, you know, smiling at the new development. Whereas actually, you know, that will become stained if they actually build the damn thing. Stained very, very quickly, and nobody will want to live there, and the windswept, you know, increase in the temperature in these kind of ghastly columns between the short and long buildings that nobody's remembered would never, you know, be a safe and comfortable place to be. The Economist, those of you who are interested in this, go and stand in the Economist Plaza with a low building and a high building. Despite the RABA medal, it's not a comfortable place to be. And the Barbican, where some people live, now the temperature is 10 degrees colder Fahrenheit inside the Barbican than outside for the same reason. No learning, right? No learning. The images are all fantastic, but the reality is something different. And the point is, because the script is reinforced all the time by the housing department, the architects department, and so on, with these images in their mind, they don't hang out in the outer reaches of Tottenham, Kilburn, the unpleasant parts of South London. There's the most amazing place called the Beckton Alps in East London, where I went with some young offenders on a ski, where this, you can ski, there's a kind of, you know, one of those artificial ski slopes. But you'd still, I mean, the wasteland, you know, still after the Blitz, you can still feel this is unreconstructed parts of London that, and they're seriously large. I mean, these are really scary places at night that have nothing to do with the vision of Canary Wharf or the Westminster or any of the kind of, if you said London, even in this room, the images that would come to your mind would not relate to these vast wastelands. And the point that's really saddest about it is that quite a lot of people live there. That is their experience of London. And then this notion of going up west and coming into, as it were, our city, which is part of this building and where most of us live, is much more than a physical journey, which some of them can afford and some of them can't. It's a psychological journey that takes them across a very big distance indeed. And a lot of them don't do it. They won't do it. It's alien territory. And that division of space into how people feel about where they are, whether they feel safe or not in their own space, is a very serious difference between people who otherwise on the tube will seem the same. But you can hardly imagine, unless you've done and had the privilege that I've had of going out into the outer reaches of these glossy cities, like the northeast Portland in Oregon, or northeast Fort Worth is another one, where these are places where islands, but not oases, just waste desert islands of frightened, really terrorized people live on very, very modest incomes, if at all. And for them, the resources of the city, the police and so on, are really the enemy. They're not friends. And what usually happens is that nobody recognizes these wastelands until something dreadful happens, like a riot. And then suddenly people start talking about, you know, Broadwater Farm or Meadowell, which the first of the clips I want to show you tonight gives you some sense of what the experience is to live on a place that feels like that. So let's have the first clip. Can I start myself, if that was going to work? And you'll see what I mean by this, because it gives us something to talk about.
The enemy. On Meadowell, the spark was a police chase, which ended in the death of two young men in a...
Whoops, what have I done already? I've stopped the sound. Sorry. This is not your fault, the LSE, it's mine. What have I just done? Oh, mute. I pressed mute. That's a mistake. This, I was warned by Richard that not to expect too much, but this is my fault. It's too fancy for me.
This isn't the first time.
Whoops, I've done it again. Sorry. Okay. This is always happens to me, by the way. I make films that I'm possibly bad at showing.
You start bringing the place down.
Okay, I'm going to rewind a bit. How many people here remember the Meadowell riots? Does anyone know where it is? It's on the, it's North Shields. Okay? There we are. Start, play. Okay, it's just outside of Newcastle. And it's outside of North Shields as well. It's about sort of 7 minutes drive outside of North Shields. It's an old... it used to be a shipbuilding
building since the weekend. It erupted in a series of fires, including this at a youth club, as a gang estimated...
The symbol of the riot was the blazing community centre, shut by the council for 2 years. The lessons of Brixton, Toxteth and Broadwater Farm were ignored. Today, riots are still triggered by tough police actions in places where they're seen as the enemy. On Meadowell, the spark was a police chase which ended in the death of two young men in a stolen car. Police saw it as an accident waiting to happen, but local youth blame police attitudes. Dale Robson's brother Mickey is still furious.
Well, I'll tell you anyway, I hate the police. 3 years ago, they killed me brother and my friend in a stolen car.
This isn't the first time that police chases had led to a crash, is it?
No.
So what was it about this one that led everyone to get, you know, start burning the place down?
Because they had been at it. They'd been at it for years and years. They're just trying to kill it all off. That's what they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
So I reckon they like the police doing that. They only turn around and say, oh, it was down your job or something. It's a job.
Yeah, but also, Mickey, they'll say, you know, you driving, or your brother driving at 80 miles an hour, is risking other people. That's going to kill people too, you know that.
I know that. I know the points about that. No, but we still need no need for them to ram them.
But I'm just saying the joyriders kill people too.
But these weren't joyriders.
They weren't.
Burning a living. And that was the only living one, no?
Come on.
Is they do things like that, not? Wasn't the pinch caused the joyriding them and that? We're getting used.
For what?
They do jobs in them.
Right. Jobs?
The odd, and now they've all gone out now, the odd ram raid or something like that.
Yeah.
Most of the time it wasn't ram raids, it would be like you burgle the place, and there's a car, get the stuff, and you're away.
What kind of life you'd like to live here?
Of course I do.
Okay, tell me about it.
Kind of life I'd like to live is just a nice peaceful one. Nice house. Nice car, something. Yeah.
How would you get it?
How would I get it? I might win at pools or something. Shot the pools or something. It's not gonna be hard, I think.
Could you imagine getting a job and doing it?
Imagine getting a job at the minute, I can't. I'm not really trying getting a job. The way I see it, I might have a chance of getting a job. But in fact, I probably wouldn't.
Now, can I do, yes, let's have some light. This is a very interesting, I mean, I found this guy when I was up in Meadowell, and I was looking around for things that would work better than prison to stop people from getting into trouble. And I went to the probation office there and said, would you show me around and take me to Meadowell? I'd like to meet the probation officer, you know, in charge of it. And the chief probation, it was his deputy, whatever, he was number two or three, said he didn't know who the probation officer was. And in fact, the probation officer had quit. I think she'd had a heart attack during the riots. And they hadn't replaced her for 6 months after the riots. He couldn't get rid of me fast enough because he didn't want to go there either. The police called it Pigsville because they just didn't like any of the people who lived on that estate. And when I got there, I had the name of the woman who ran the community center, the community action group. And it turned out they were squatting in their own offices and having a meeting there because they had criticized the council for closing the brand new community center that they had built within 2 years of building it, because there had been a rates freeze by the government. So their decision about how to implement the rates freeze was to close this brand new youth center. And obviously, local people didn't like that. So because they criticized it, their grant was cut, and they had to literally squat in their own offices. And when I went in there, the really interesting thing was that these were people who were obviously very angry, but they were being resourceful about how to rescue this place that had just been burned down. And what they said, there was an 80-year-old woman called Nancy Peters reporting to this little group of improvised locals, saying, what we should do, what we have done, is we've gone to Tottenham, to Broadwater Farm, and found that the Broadwater Farm people said, after they'd had a riot there, that they were going to ask not that 12 million quid be spent on new building by some firm like Taylor Woodrow, but that the local kids would be taught how to become builders, and that the money that they would make from the contract of rebuilding their own estate would pay for these kids to be trained and go to college or to send the old people to the West Indies, which I thought was fantastic, and so did they. The other interesting thing was, there was a copper there at the end in plain clothes who said, by the way, I'm Sergeant Alan Evans, and I've just been assigned to you along with 10 other men. And they didn't believe him. And what had happened was the chief constable had said, these people have to be brought in to the community. And they had been excluded completely. Nobody ever answered calls. They called them Pigsville and so on. And so this group of ordinary coppers suddenly became part of this community, this excluded community. And what you should understand about Mickey Robson was that that interview was done something like, well, in the end, well, by the time I got him to sit down and talk, was about a year, maybe 2 years, no, he said 3 years ago from the original time that they'd been killed. But he had been carrying a machete around for those 3 years with this black rage in his jaw. Any of you know psychology, you can see that rage. And I was the first person to sit down and talk to him in all that time. Nobody had gone and found him. Everyone was either scared or just hated him, and he hated them. So actually, I talked to him for 6 hours before I turned the camera on, literally just sitting there, and just trying to get him back into a point where he could have a conversation. And then when I asked him, do you ever dream, you saw that smile. You know, I just thought that's his, the carapace breaks into that smile. Do I dream? Of course I do. Yeah? And he suddenly becomes a person. And it's that notion that these guys, who the police absolutely loathe, are beyond the pale. And that notion of where and what happens beyond the pale is what I'm talking about in cities. That there is a pale, and beyond it, nobody cares. And the mistake they made in the 19th century in London, thinking they could build squares and lock the gates and not worry about what happened in Somers Town in the fetid swamps that you read about in Bleak House, the opening of Bleak House so beautifully, was that cholera penetrated the comfort of the middle classes. So they had to provide sanitation for the rest of the city because they were dying otherwise. And my claim about how cities work is that the notion of the gated community, these teepees in the desert, as somebody called them in France, it's rather a nice image, they're kidding themselves. We are kidding ourselves. If we think we can lock out the Mickey Robinsons of this world by simply building a gate and saying, you know, hiring a concierge who's probably from a third world country themselves and has no idea what the problem is, this is just a kind of fantasy. But it looks good on the image. It fits the script. The idea of the safe place is one where the enemy is kept out. And the real task is to neutralize the enemy, not to keep them out, simply to stop them being the enemy, to turn them into something else. But that involves the leap into enemy territory. The question, what would it take to get you to stop doing what you're doing, may take a positive answer that it doesn't fit the script. And the reason it doesn't fit the script is because it involves you thinking for them, including them into your script. And since they're the enemy, and by definition that makes you the good guy, there's a problem there. In order for you to feel good about yourself, you have to feel bad about somebody else, sort of in the eye and out. So it's very interesting how cities throw people together but actually keep them apart. And what the work that I'm trying to suggest to you, the best work that I've seen around the world trying to find this problem, does the opposite. It includes people. And just in case, just to labor the point a little bit more heavily, and in a way that I hope it might be useful to you, ask yourself, if your brother, son, child, whatever, friend, got into trouble, which of the following four things would you do? Would you make sure you spent some time with them and really try to see what was going on with them? Would you, if they were your own child, would you send them abroad into a new environment so they mixed with different people and had challenges? If you thought there was something wrong with them, would you try and get them help, psychological help, reading help, physical help, whatever? Or would you lock them up in a lavatory with two or three other bad kids? And if that didn't work, lock them up for longer. Right? Now, this is not rocket science, but that is what we're doing. Yesterday, Michael Howard, in the terrible sight of a flak jacket, bursts into houses on television to show how tough he's going to be and says the answer is truth in sentencing, longer sentences, lock up people, and if we don't have enough prison cells, let's build them for long, build more of them. I mean, there is no learning. There is no learning. And this is what I'm really, the point of this is that your own experience, what happens to you, what makes you feel safe, what makes you not be criminals, is that you have something to lose. You get more out of not being criminal than you get out of being one. You would feel uncomfortable. And what he says is, right, they're doing a job. For them, this is normal. You have these overlapping groups in communities in which the rules are very real. They are more punitive to each other. There was a scene that, if the sound was better, I was going to play for you, of car thieves in South London. Wonderful scene. In a project called the Ilderton Motor Project. It's been going for 20 years in Lewisham. And the discipline in that place is run by the kids themselves. And the volunteers who run it are all themselves ex-car thieves. And what they're given is a chance to race, to build cars and then race them in Wimbledon track if they're really good. And then they spend the rest of the time building them. But every Wednesday night they sit down and say, right, whoever's been caught driving illegally or whatever, any of the other rules, breaking them, they sit there and they really throw the book at them. They kick them out. They're much tougher than, you know, Guardian readers would be on them. And it's very interesting that, because there are rules here. This is not amoral territory. It just doesn't perfectly match ours, right? So it's important that we understand that. And the other thing that I want to kind of give you tonight as this kind of present, if you will, is to really unpick. Whenever I hear the word community, I reach for my gun. I really think it is such a fiction because it is lumping together people who are at odds. And one of the most interesting things I saw about this question of how you are, who are you from Sunderland, are you from Gateshead, are you from Meadowell, and so on, is that in Durham Prison, where a lot of these kids end up, the ones from Gateshead and Sunderland, which is about as near as you can get up there from two different places with different names, will happily beat up all the kids from Manchester, but they hate each other. They will not see that they're from the Northeast and therefore they're together. Those of you who are students and read my book, Living Dangerously, will see that one of the characters in the book talks about how they divide up their own estate into one side and the other and how they hate each other. And there's a very interesting story in there about a boy called Winston who talks to me, who's from Hackney, and he talks to me very painfully about the journey to visit his cousins in Clapham because he has to go through Brixton. And the Brixton boys don't know the difference between Tottenham and Hackney. And the Tottenham boys were really, really tough and had done lots of terrible things to the Brixton boys. And if you're black and come from northeast London, you are seen as a Tottenham boy, even if you're from Hackney. But because he's got a cousin in Brixton, the cousin gives him safe passage across Brixton to get to Clapham, right? Now, we're talking about London, where we all move between these places. Hackney's rather trendy now. Certainly, Brixton has become that way. But not if you're 19 years old, black, and frightened. He was worried to me about his 7-year-old nephew who was already carrying a knife out of fear. Now, we've got a clip from Boston, but I think it would mean leaping over the next one. Let's see what happens next here. I want to give you some illustrations about this because it's really, I mean, it's almost impossible for me as a middle-aged, middle-class white man standing up here talking about this experience. Why I've got the clips is that I want you to see how real this is.
No matter what's been done to you.
We lived on the Meadowell for 8.
Sorry, this is a different clip, but it's very interesting and it's relevant. The point about this clip is this is a woman who tells the story of living on the Meadowell estate and trying, just because kids were harassing her and her child in the evening, what the consequences of that are. And what you need to understand, and I'll tell you the story at the end of this, this is what happened simply because, if the accent's difficult for you, her husband goes down and tells these kids to stop playing football against their garage door.
10:15, and this gang of youths come past, and they had stones, and they started throwing them at the windows. So I opened the bedroom window, and I shouted, look, push off, and Jimmy was downstairs. And he says, look, it's 10:15, I've got children, got to get up for school in the morning, leave her alone. All hell broke loose. They were there with 4-foot-long, 4x4 planks of wood that had broke a fence down, and nails, rusty 4-inch nails, and they started beating him. There were 7 of them. When I got ready and got across the road, he had a nail had gone through his nose, and it was just open. It was just, the bone was just all out. His skull, the nails had gone through his skull, all his upper body, his arms were just nails. Because of this group of hooligans, nobody could do anything because it's an unwritten law on the Meadowell. Yeah, you want to help, but you can't.
Fordham?
Now, what's interesting, can we have the lights up just for a second, and we'll go on to the next group in a second. What's interesting is what happened to her. Her husband, and you know, you understood. Did everyone understand the accent? These terrible rusty nails penetrating her skull. Because all they'd done was say, get away from the house, our kid is sleeping. And they were really, he was pulverized. So they called the police, which is very, very risky. And the police came, and they were so angry about this, they gave a statement, and they were willing to go to court. Now, the criminal justice system, as our protection, we wouldn't think that was a particularly brave thing to do. But on an estate like Meadowell, that's called grassing.
Right.
So what then followed was a whole period of torture, and that is the right word for it. They were tortured. Their house was besieged. Their children were beaten up. At Christmas, there were literally gas bombs thrown into their house, paint all over they're saying grass, because they had called the police and objected to the father being attacked so viciously for no reason. They had to move house. They were put in a safe house nearby. And the word got out that that's who they were. And the same thing happened again, even in a community where they hadn't done it, as it were, done nothing. They had actually, the reputation was that they would grasp people up as if that nothing, wrong had happened to them. And they had to move a third time. The second time. And by the time I met her, I had to go through the police, I had to come in anonymously, and she was terrified in there, and she describes in another film of the series what it was like, her 8-year-old child being kicked in the crotch, her son, 10-year-old, being strangled, and I mean strangled, because she called the police and testified. And the magistracy heard the case, but a different magistrate did the sentencing a week later. And so they were given community punishment, and the people who'd done it never even left the streets. Right? So you are living next door to that kind of terror. Can you imagine that? You just have to put yourself in their shoes to imagine that. Now, the kind of people who do that start very young on these estates, 6, 7. I met fire raisers who were terrifying the adults around, age 6 and age 7, and we'll see a bit more of them. But what they did is an attempt to try and engage these guys, and this is something really interesting, I've never seen it anywhere else. Led by the vicar, who's a brilliant guy called Charles Hope, and the woman from the housing department, and the man who ran the health center, which wasn't burned down because he engaged, right next door to the community center, which was burned down because it was shut, they went into Durham Prison to tell the people from Meadowell what was happening on their estate. So instead of saying, you're out of sight, out of mind, we don't care until you come back, they tried to give them some kind of engagement with the place where they lived. And it's interesting that, because I'd never seen that done before. So these guys are all long-term sentence prisoners from the Meadowell. Come on. Should be playing. Why is it not playing?
With 5 and 7 years, burgling the chemist to get a handful of silicone wobbly eggs so they could just get a better buzz. And from there they went to another chemist and took another handful of wobbly eggs. And they're in prison doing 7s and 5 years for that. They should be getting some kind of medical help instead of stuck in prison. I'll tell you something now. Everybody from that Meadowell estate is in prison and you're going to get another whiplash. Because I remember years ago, and I remember back, that they cleared the whole streets. Can you remember they cleared everybody, and then all of a sudden they all got out, boom, and they hit the streets again. Havoc hit the Meadowell. Everybody just was going boom, 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 all over the shop.
I have never ever felt unsafe on Meadowell until this last few months. Never ever have I felt as though I couldn't walk these streets, and yet on Friday night I was frightened walking home. You're hearing of all these muggings and things going on, and people breaking into houses while they're actually in. You know, that the young people on the estate just now have got so brave and courageous, they're just not frightened of anybody. I think they need educating until we can get the parents to take some part of the responsibility for their kids. We're all fighting a losing battle.
Offenders with not...
Interesting. That woman, her name is Carol Bell, she's an ex-prostitute, went straight, married a ship's captain, and went to the Meadowell and led a kind of community action group, if you like, herself. And she became a national figure in some ways because she was so brave and so angry. But her son fell into the same crowd. Her son was Mickey's best friend and got into very big trouble and was going to go down. And the interesting thing was, she says in another part of this interview, that trying to get him to take himself seriously would involve becoming a ship's captain, reading books. And he's very bright at this point. But he didn't even go to the library because he wouldn't imagine that he'd be allowed in. He said, if I tried to go to the library, they'd throw me out. That's how distant he felt from the system. And the government did put in 12 million quid worth of new housing, but they wouldn't pay for the youth club, and there are 3,000 kids on that estate. So the youth worker had to sell a car to pay their wages. Now this is what we're talking about, the mismatch. They became part of the national conversation by burning themselves down. They got 12 million quid to rebuild the place, but nobody would fund the youth club so that the kids would not have to just set fire to buildings to amuse themselves. And the next scene, I think it is, we see that the firemen called by these seven, you know, called out by fires lit by 6 and 7 and 8 year olds because they love the noise and the excitement of getting the fire stations going. These are the empty houses on the estate because nobody wants to live there because it's too dangerous. And it's quite built quite recently. So the notion in this city's program that you can build your way out of a social predicament like that is just fantasy. But it's comfortable fantasy because you can stay in an office, design the building, send people to build it, and you never have to engage with the people who are going to live there.
What are we fighting and losing that?
In offenders with nothing to lose, the justice system is no deterrent. It's an occupational hazard. The best form of rehabilitation and crime prevention is a job. With the mines, shipyards and steelworks closed, Meadowell formed a building co-op to train and employ local youth. Fittingly, their first commission is to rebuild the community centre burned down in the riot.
You were in trouble before?
Car theft, theft from shops. Nothing mainly to border towards violence, nothing like that, but I did break the law a lot.
How many lads on the site would you say have been in trouble before?
Out of 15, about 10. I'll go as far as say 10. If it wasn't for the fact that they've been given the chance now, I'd, you know.
Most would be in jail.
Do you see young lads around who were in the position you were in before?
Every day. I mean, you see them walking past the sites, you know, all the time.
What does that make you feel?
Makes lucky. You feel lucky.
It's kick-started me in action sort of thing, you know. Made me look towards like me work and life a lot more seriously than that.
That's a sense of pride, that building something. That's what this is good for. We're building something what we can see we've done. My kid will be coming here and I can bring him down to look, I'll build that for you.
Give him one more challenge to work and show that we can work, you know. Where before there was nothing for you, you know. It's just crime.
When you were into crime, if somebody came along to you and said you could have a job and here's the job, would that have stopped you?
Aye. Yeah, definitely. Aye.
Because that's the only reason you do things like that for money. And if you've got a job that's bringing you regular income, you're not going to deal, are you?
So it wasn't for kicks?
No, never for kicks. If anybody had given us a chance beforehand, I would have snapped it up. You know, but up until now, no one had given us a chance.
I just want to earn, just keep this job and keep my family going, you know. But if I got put on the door tomorrow, I might have to put on my body clover and do some work.
Sorry, can we turn the lights on again? Could everyone understand that? Because the Northern accent's rather difficult. No, didn't understand it. All right, well, what they were saying was that the job, they all were in crime before, that they actually got a huge amount out of getting the chance to build that. One of them says, I'm doing this for my kids, I can bring them there and say, I built this for you. And what they most hope to do is to get a job and keep that job. But there's one, the one says at the end, if I didn't have that, I would go back to crime. I'd have to put on my ballot crime and go to work. And that idea of working through crime is absolutely fundamental to what I'm talking about. Crime is a job for them, just like our jobs for us. I've actually had people talk about going shopping in other people's houses. This is a normative behavior. It is not odd. It is not just a rite of passage. These days, there's a great criminologist who was from Cambridge who said that what the best thing to do about crime is a four-letter word, L-E-S-S. But it's no longer true, because the fragmentation of the employment patterns means that you can't expect just to go into the shipbuilding and have a job for life. It won't be like that. The apprenticeships have disappeared. So for young people, their apprenticeship is crime. They start carrying drugs, maybe, because they don't get arrested because they're younger. They've got territorial interests, according to the drug dealers that have taken an interest in them, but they actually, this is a career path. And when one of the young offenders, again, my book, said to me, you know, Raj, he said, I've given up crime. And I said, oh, that's nice. He said, I just deal from home. right? Because what that actually means, he's off the streets, which makes it a little less dangerous, but he's got a future, he's got a cash flow, he's got some security. Now, the most important thing, and I'm sorry about the northern accents, I really should have chosen a different set of examples for you, but the point that that sort of little journey around Meadowell was intended to show you, and I could have done the same thing in San Francisco or in Boston, where I've got clips, but we've run out of time, is that the territorial ownership of these wastelands is divided up between fearful groups who define their identity by their engagement with that space and each other. If we don't pay attention to them, they're the ones who they pay attention to each other. Now, either you pay positive attention to them and give them jobs, let them build something they can be proud of, or they will tear it down in order to feel better about themselves, because that negativity is what they've been raised with all along. They've been kicked out of schools. It is no accident that, as many of you know, the postal districts in which the prisoners in most in most countries live are a small number of these wastelands. Half in Texas are from places in Houston and Fort Worth, half the state prison. Half of New York comes from certain parts of New York City. The same in England. Certain districts, certain postal districts. In Boston, South Boston, it's one street, quite a short street, that feeds the prisons, because that street, if you it's called Intervale Street in Dorchester, South Dorchester. It's got a tree full of trainers, Adidas trainers, and if you wear Reeboks onto that street, you may get shot, because they use the label to identify themselves with and say, we're from Intervale, you all hate us, but our Adidas makes us heroes. And anybody who comes in differently is an enemy, whether it's police or another young person. And in the shadow of Ernest Gellner, you know, in this building, you can sense how deep and how ancient that tradition is. It's tribal, it's human, and it's absolutely inevitable. So if we want to walk those streets safely, we have to neutralize them. We have to make those kids feel safe. There's a scene, again, we don't have time, but I will show you, of all the knives collected by the Boston school police in 1 month. And it's a box filling the table with the most terrible knuckle dusters and huge knives that these were kids carrying them to school in order to be safe walking home from school. And for them, the hours that are in danger are not at night. It's just going home from school. Now, if you can think of the distance, and I mean the psychological distance, between your journeys here and home, and then imagine if you felt that you were in danger from almost anybody you saw, including the police. Then you've got an idea of what the forgotten, invisible citizens of cities feel like. And that's what I've been trying to talk to you about, making them more visible, but not just by forcing them to burn themselves down to get our attention. Thanks.
Well, this is really a chance for you to talk to Roger. Usually people make comments. I'm not going to make lots of them. I do want to ask you one thing, which is that I think one of the strong themes that comes in general out of what you're saying is that there's an enormous disconnect between the way politicians talk about crime and the experience of crime on the ground. Have you thought about ways in order to make politicians and political discourse face up to this reality? What can be done about this? How do we rescue this from this kind of bourgeois prison that politics has put this discussion in?
It's a very interesting problem, this. And a colleague of mine from here, who's here from the probation service, knows it extremely well. And that is this, that when the people who talk about crime and victims and the need to protect victims miss the single most important point about all these statistics, and that is, by far the largest group of victims is the same group as the offenders, is young white males under 25. Why? Because they're on the streets all the time, and they're very touchy and very fearful. So if you go out with a knife and somebody looks at you the wrong way, you want respect, and you will
forfeit your probation, your whatever, to protect your amour propre. Right? So the victims that everybody says, who thinks about the victim? Well, the answer is not these politicians or the Daily Mail, because they have this fantasy that it's little old ladies being mugged by strangers all the time. Well, little old ladies stay at home. They're very, very rare. They're far and away the safest group in the whole of society. But to get politicians to acknowledge they're on the side of the young victims would mean they'd have to be on the same side as the young offenders. And then the Mail would have them for lunch, breakfast, and dinner. And that's the problem, is the duality between the reality, which is almost indigestible because it doesn't fit their script, and the script, which bears no resemblance at all to the reality. So that's not an answer to the question, but that's what the problem is. Yeah. What do we
how
do?
How do we stop this this kind of political fantasy then?
Well, what I've tried to do, and I think actually one of the few achievements that I could probably say I'd had some hand in, is that when I went around America looking for positive solutions, Jack Straw was then the Home Secretary and invited me to show my rushes to a whole ministerial group about this and talk about the positive ways forward of engaging people. And then they set up the Youth Justice Board along these principles, and so I think we influenced that. And then they brought all the people I've been working with in America over for a couple of days to talk to the people doing it here. And you know, I think there is progress being made. I think the Youth Justice Board is a real step forward. And the ministers who get behind it and really stand up to the Daily Mail, that is an education for them, because they go and meet the kids. They see the kids are like their kids. They want the same things. But if you only demonize them, if you use that medieval language of spider boy and rat boy, and you know, all you're saying is they're different, whereas actually they're the same.
Can I ask you to ask Roger questions? You have him here. Yes. Would you like a microphone, just so other people can hear you?
How would you be tough on the causes of crime?
Well, the causes of crime, it's very interesting, this. The predictors, I'll just briefly tell you, the 8 predictors of future serious persistent offending, which is what Mr. Howard says he's so concerned with, are the following. They're poor housing and frequent moves. There are educational problems and learning difficulties and exclusion from school and truanting. There are child abuse in the family and domestic violence. There's drink and drugs in the family. I can't remember the other three, but the crucial one is that the single biggest predictor of future offending, harsh and erratic parenting. Not soft, not liberal parenting, but harsh parenting. These kids get beaten regularly for any offense from very, very young. And the other one, which is interesting, is having an older brother, sibling, or a parent convicted before the child is 10, right? In other words, the criminal justice system makes more criminals. That every time it catches somebody, it is increasing the likelihood of their child or sibling going into crime, because it normalizes it, okay? So to address the causes of crime, you don't just punish more people. In fact, you couldn't. That is itself a cause of crime. What you have to do is give them a reason not to do it. That's what you have to do. You have to address all those 7 predictors, increase mental health and one of the prisoners there, which you, in that language you couldn't understand, was saying, these kids go to prison for 5 and 7 years for stealing temazepam tablets from chemists, right? And he says, right, this long-term robber, why don't they give them help instead? And you will find it unbelievable, as I do, that there are no provisions for heroin addiction under 16-year-olds anywhere in Britain. And we've known about this problem for years. That the youth clubs, which in the film, I could show you, in San Francisco, it becomes a safe place for kids to hide from gangs, are shut in the weekends and the school holidays. It's unbelievable. So far from addressing the causes of crime, we know what they are. But until you burn down the estate, nobody wants to invest in the early stages. Sorry, Richard, I know I'm just doing, but one really crucial point I didn't make. The narrative of investment has to have a visible impact. So you will get people knocking down instead of rehabilitating an interesting part of a city, because you can see the tower block and name it after the councillor. the thought you will then have to spend money on maintaining it, there are no brownie points in that. You don't write stories about the fact that the lift is working, right? And therefore, the lift stops working, and it becomes dangerous. And only when they tear the place down again do you get back into the newspapers by blowing up the Spruitt-Igoe or whatever estate it is that has become too dangerous, right? In other words, in semiological terms, there has to be an event. And the embarrassment and disappointment of getting involved with kids who have learning difficulties and, you know, getting beaten up all the time and the parents, you know, don't want to know and so on, is that the hope that you are raising is bound to be disappointed quite a lot of the time. As opposed to, we've caught this kid, we've locked him up, and he's off the street. We don't have to worry about what's going to happen when he comes out.
Elena Kennedy.
In this arena and listening to you and watching your clips, he would have said, this is the argument for ASBOs. Do you think that ASBOs are the answer to this problem?
Well, the antisocial behavior order is a civil limitation on the behavior of kids like those who drive everybody mad. And actually, one of the very first one was imposed on a kid in that estate who was 7 or 8, 9 years old and was endlessly escaping from school. His father would take him to school, he'd run out the back and then spend the whole day with other kids burning down houses. So he had an ASBO forbidding him to go to certain street corners and hang out with certain kids. He was 9, right? Of course, what a surprise, he didn't adhere to it, so he was sent to secure accommodation. And one of the reasons why the prison population is going up, especially among young people, is that they are breaching these civil orders and they're being punished with criminal offenses and being put into prison for it. So the answer is, the second part of that is, where you banish them from here, where are they supposed to go? Are they supposed to go stay in their home where they're going to get beaten up by their parents? Great, that's a terrific idea. Are they going to go to some new part of town where nobody knows them so they can burgle to their heart's content because nobody knows who they are? I mean, ASBOs are the perfect model of what not to do, because all it is half the solution. It looks like a solution. On paper, it's fantastic. But the consequences, and sorry, the last irony of this, is that the politicians are always saying, we want to teach these guys to take responsibility for their actions. If only David Blunkett and Michael Howard would do that, we would be in a much better place.
There's a kind of interpretation about what lies behind, about certain forms of this violence. Not the violence of killing the man, but a violence like burning the houses, like, you know, sort of what has now, we call it urban violence. It is not about burglary, it's not about murder. And one of the notions is that it's about acts of speech.
Yes.
Now it's,
exactly.
And so it just struck me that you as a filmmaker, you get them to talk, and they talk. And do you have? And you have a very special angle into that. The people that I know who are doing this kind of work, they're all social scientists, so they go with ready-made questions, you know. And it's like, oh, you know. And do you have a sense that it is about talking? I mean, we humans are really talkers, right? And you have a notion that a particular kind of violence happens to these people, which is that nobody gets it. They cannot explain what's wrong with the condition they're in. You know, I mean, it would put me in a total rage, I must say. You know, the sense of total impotence on the most elementary level. Now, by the time they're doing massive violence, they are far removed probably from that original insight. You know, I can't talk about my condition. But tell us a bit more about two things. About one is, do you have a sense that it does matter, you know, the possibility of speaking about your condition? And secondly, is there some sort of formula in there that we can use? Because in a way, if there were the possibility to have more acts of communication from those people, that they feel that they're really communicating, this might be sort of an interesting, you know, and you can do that on a mass scale, but any forum, schools, prisons, churches, you know, whatever, television, of course.
Well, one of the most interesting things, and I'm going to invoke Gellner again, you know, is that in all, you know, great ethnography and anthropology, the rituals of birth and death are crucial. And one of the tragedies that I happened on in all sorts of parts of the world is how seldom deaths among these invisible kids are honored or acknowledged. And so you have this rage simmering, as it was in Mickey, and it's never acknowledged. There's not even a funeral, really, except for the mother, you know, a local little funeral. But for, I was at a school, I mean, I was at a group of offenders in northeast Portland, black kids, one of whose mother was on the game and was literally outside where we were, and she kept knocking on the door saying, could we have some money, give her some money. And they were all putting a board together of pictures of their dead brothers. It was incredibly moving because it was the first time they'd been allowed to talk about their dead brothers. And one of them said, you know, one of the things that makes me so upset is that at our school, nobody mentioned that he was killed. But when the headmaster's cat had been run over, they had half a day off for school. And that gives you some idea of the value placed on black kids' life. And the people in this city that have talked to me, including that boy I was describing from Hackney, absolutely believe that there are a lot of black kids who have been killed by each other, and nobody's even recorded their death. Now, whether that's an urban myth or not is almost untestable, but I've heard it from a number of sources. They believe that. And it's, you're absolutely right. The acknowledgement of their lives and the acknowledgement of their losses is one of the key steps to including them. And then, otherwise, they stay invisible.
Yes.
You mentioned that one of the most effective ways to prevent crime is to give people an option. But the examples that you gave, particularly the youth centers and the, for example, training co-ops, are at a grassroots level. Can you suggest any policy initiatives that would bring this up to either the local or the national level? Because that really seems to be the issue.
Yes, actually, it's interesting, that question. I mean, I think that business and the church are the two missing players in this. That it's very interesting, this. When I was part of the Home Office Retail Crime Initiative or something, we were looking at the relationship between store detectives and shoplifters. And shoplifters, everybody shoplifts. I mean, I wouldn't ask hands to go up here, but you know, I certainly have done it when I was a kid, and it's a very, very common first-time offense. And a very interesting thing, the what's the figure? It's 1/3 of British males have been convicted of a criminal offense by the age of 32, and 1/4 of them by the age of 21, right? Usually shoplifting. And but the stores didn't care. They didn't actually want to engage. And we were promoting a restorative justice thing out of the Thames Valley Police, where at least some shop owner would meet one of the kids and sit down and talk to them about what it meant to lose your stock. And that idea that the business community would adopt young offenders, train them in prison or train them in probation schemes, sponsor training schemes, give them a chance so that they would protect their own kids, their own interests, and so on. That's a leap that some companies have made, but very few. And I know the Probation Service, now it's called NOMS, the National Offender Management Service, they are trying to do this. And the Paul Hamilton Foundation, with some of the people here we are working, we're trying to do that. But and there are a growing number of people that recognize this. But the other people that are missing the equation are the church. And the times that I've gone to churches or to vicars and chaplains and said, do you try and involve the local church to bring them in? And they say, our parishioners don't want people like that in our church. Some Christianity there. But they don't. And so only in Boston, again, I saw it happen in Boston simply because one of the funerals that did happen led to a gang fight in the church. And the vicar, who had himself been a gang member and risen through, you know, out of Philadelphia to Boston and became part of Harvard Divinity School, he suddenly woke up and said, do you know what we've been doing? All these years, we've been fighting for civil rights. We haven't noticed that our kids have been going down the drain. And he turned this into an idea that 40 churches across America were going to adopt the kids of people who were in prison. And it's a very systematic approach. It has to be grassroots. You can't have, that's the very thing that Rich was talking about, is the danger. You hear all the right things being talked about, but nobody really does it. It's the delivery. Head Start, the best program possible for young people, actually is all based on the model in one place, Ypsilanti, Michigan, where it was done properly because the teachers went into the homes of the parents to see if they got it. All the other Head Start programs, everybody comes to the place. But to actually spend the money and go into these dangerous places, that's too scary for them. And they only got permanent funding from a 1964 health program under Clinton. That's how long it took. All the money was temporary. So the delivery at the grassroots level is all there is. National policy, great, but until it actually happens, what you get is more cynicism. Because these are kids whose promises have always been broken by parents, teachers, police, locals. And unless you deliver and get through their barrier of disbelief in the possibility, as Mickey says, that there might be a better option, they won't trust it.
Yes. But you must use the microphone.
You've been talking this evening about a sort of invisibility of groups, but I was struck by the film clips that you showed where, although you've made the point that victims and perpetrators are often drawn from the same community, it was very broadly the women shown as victims or activists, and the criminals were young men. And I wondered if you want to comment upon the growth or the changing perceptions of roles in crime by gender.
Well, it's a very interesting drive. Certainly the rise in the prison population for women is one of the great scandals in recent years, but a lot of that has been not paying a TV license fee or being mules and carrying drugs, and women suffer from exactly the same poverty and drives and abuse and so on that men do, if not more. But they also want to belong. And because they're frightened, the rituals, humiliation of joining a gang gives them some sense of protection. And the bullying that goes on in schools and goes on the streets cannot be exaggerated. I'm trying to convey this to you in this comfort here, but the fear of girls going home on the streets is absolute from other girls as well as from other boys. And therefore, the same dynamic and the same hardening is going on. And the saddest thing of all, and this is really heartbreaking, is that the kids who are doing this now even talk, as Saskia's talking about the coldness in their heart, because they have felt so abandoned and so crushed by the experience of abuse in the early years of all kinds, emotional abuse as well, that by 12, they either fall apart or go cold. And then if they are cold, they will drive other kids to do things in the coldness that literally terrorizes them. And a lot of the mugging that went on for mobile phones in Hackney was driven by two Mauritian, I think they were orphans, I'm not sure, but they were kids without parental control who had reached that stage. And they simply created such havoc and fear around them that other kids felt that either they had to join them, which they did, by becoming muggers of mobile phones, or they would be permanent victims. And the girls were part of that.
Yes, in the back. I'm going to take students.
I wanted to ask if you could reflect on a situation that a friend recently shared with me. He was on one of the buses leaving Aldwych here during the afternoon, and what he described was a group of five or six boys around the age of 12 who were on the upper part of the bus and started harassing women in particular, adult women, much older than these boys, with behavior that was language and gestures that were quite sexually explicit and aggressive. And as he described the situation, he said that basically no one responded for the most part, and then started to respond with, now you need to stop this. Eventually someone told the bus driver, and the bus driver implied that he would stop the bus and have the boys get off, but never actually did that. And there was this whole description, and when I heard it, I was really struck by what I pictured was a sort of paralysis or a just inability to effectively respond in a way that would be effective and humane and proactive. And I'm just wondering what your reflections are on that in terms of a society. How do we learn to equip ourselves and develop?
Okay. There's a very interesting answer to that, which I hope, I hate to be in that situation. It's really tricky, and it happens on trains occasionally as well. But what they did in Strasbourg and in Rotterdam, when the same things have been happening on the trams and so on. I mean, in Strasbourg, the suburbs of, I haven't even talked about France, but the suburbs, French suburbs, are really dangerous, some of them. And the one outside Strasbourg is so dangerous, the postman won't go there and deliver post. And so the tram becomes the only way into that suburb and back out. And what they've done is they've hired ex-gang members to be what they call ambassadors. And both in Rotterdam and in Strasbourg, it works. And I think New York Transit was starting to do something like that as well. Yes, but the Angels were volunteers. But I think, you know, other cities have picked up on that. They simply take people who have street cred. In Boston, they're called street workers. A lot of them are ex-gang members. They're paid for out of the mayor's office, so they're not actually part of the justice system, but they appear in court as friends in court, and they know these kids. So that's what you have to have, and give a future to the kids that isn't about crime. And oddly enough, there's a relief when they come out of it. It's hugely pressured to be part of this. They're permanently in fear, and they never feel any pride in the money. It's a kind of buzz, but it's not pride. And they talk about working and work and earning. There's two different things. And when they earn something that they've really, you know, even if it's just a simple job, they're proud of that and they don't spend it, and they hate being fined because they think the state is stealing their money, right? And then they'll go out and steal some money to pay the fine rather than give up the money they've earned legitimately because that's theirs.
Let's have a last question. Victoria Glendening, you get the last.
Can I show a little thing?
Yes, oh. And then we'll see. Yes, ask one more question, and then we will. And then we'll see this.
You said at the beginning, with great emphasis, Roger, you said there is no learning. There is no learning. Like every generation has to make the same mistakes over and over again, as if we were the first people ever. And then when you told that story about the Adidas tree,
yes,
you said it is tribal, it is human.
Yes.
And it's as if, in fact, we're taking the tea with a teaspoon, the sea with a teaspoon in a kind of a way, because the veneer of civilization on human nature is pretty thin anyway, and we have to learn again in every generation. In that, I wanted you to say whether you felt that incrementally and in pockets, in oases, in cities all over the world, progress was being made.
Well, I've seen enough good examples to continue to keep doing this. And I mean, some people are here from Brainchild, which did some work with Crime Concern in Manchester with kids from an estate just like Meadowell. And they said, give us a radio station, because we all want to do music. And if you let us become DJs and do the things that are exciting for them, they'll do that. This is the single binding theme of all the young people that I've ever known of all social classes, which is they complain that there's not enough to do, right? And they hang out on the street saying there's not enough to do, wherever it is. You know, public school boys say it just like kids from the worst places. And the reason is, somehow or other, it isn't theirs. There isn't something that they own. And if you give them the chance to do something that they can feel good about themselves doing, they respond. And coming back to the cities program, if you like, the one thing that terrifies me is that people will think that all you have to do is build a community center and then with, you know, the odd ping pong table, and you've solved these identity questions. But apart from the fact that they're shut when the kids are actually wanting to play on them, there is the sense of the fact that it was given to them. And there has to be some way in which they make it themselves and then can feel good about that. And I've watched this. I've watched kids use their hands in probation centers and build pots and build tables and build bookshelves and so on. And no amount of talking about their offending, as good as and interesting as it was for me, equals that sense of pride that they'd made something that was theirs. And one of them, I will end with this. Anyone wants to stay, I'll show that Boston stuff, but this is more positive. One of them was caught by the worker who ran the workshop in Hackney, the guy I was talking about, in fact, who has been just wonderfully, over the 10 weeks, he became more and more engaged, and the work was good, and he smiled a lot, and he was a great guy. But in Hackney, he was, you know, just, he was really threatening. And the worker asked me to go and talk to Winston and say, what's the difference? He almost didn't recognize him. Why were you so fearsome on the street and so open amongst us? And you know what he said? He said, well, Roger, you have to understand, he said, to be Winston in Hackney, you're not so hello, hello.
Okay. On that note, can we thank Roger for a wonderful presentation?
Yeah. Wonderful.
great. Well, thank you, and I hope that we'll see all of you next week when Ira Katznelson continues the series.